Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear David Arroyo.
I hate confrontation. Like one time I was in the subway and this drunk guy sat on me for about 3 minutes.
That and more, but before that, I just want to give a little shout out to our latest Patreon members, Richard Whiting and Sarah M. We always give a shout out when someone gives us $25 a month or more. We are so, so thankful to Richard and Sarah and all of our Patreon members. Don't forget that you can become a Patreon member for as little as a dollar a month if you like, and there's so much incredible content to be found there. There are now over 50 bonus stories that you've never heard on the free podcast that are there. And the latest Patreon check-in that I recorded was an extensive interview with Risk story coach Cindy Freeman. And we really got into a lot of profound stuff in that conversation. So go over to patreon.com/risk and become a member and help us keep this running. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. Oh, shit. Who is this behind me now? Oh, fuck. God damn it. Where did I put it? It's Capiozo and Mecco. Jesus Christ. And we're calling this week's episode Bounce Back. Can I bounce back after that miserable intro? I kind of feel like I'm bouncing back a bit after a pretty rough July. And I have to say, it was a lot of the stories we've been working on that were inspiration to me, that kind of like reminded me to keep on keeping on. I mean, you know, without getting all negative about things. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear a story by Diana Dinnerman that she shared at a Los Angeles show of ours a while back. She can be found on Twitter at ddinnerman. But before that, we're going to hear a story that was recorded in New York at our show at Caveat. This is David Arroyo. He has a YouTube channel called Arroyo 2099. And here is David now with a story we call Undercover Puerto Rican.
Hey guys, so it's around June, and it's one of those really hot, steamy New York summer days. I'm in the subway. It's like 110 degrees. I'm sweating like crazy. There's sweat in my eyes. My eyes sting. And I have these two gigantic bags full of crap from the thrift store. Basically crap to make my crappy apartment look less crappy. So the train comes in. Doors open up. And like every New Yorker, you rush in to grab a seat, right? So I rush in to grab a seat. And there's no seats. But I look and I see this girl. She's wearing a Puerto Rican t-shirt and a Puerto Rican bandana. She has two bags taking up two seats on the bench, which I fucking hate. But, you know, I'm standing there, and what you gotta know about me, guys, is that I hate confrontation. Like one time I was in the subway, and this drunk guy sat on me for about 3 minutes before I got up and left the train. So normally I would just stand there. And I would just let the seats go. But at the time, I was living in the Bronx, and I'm going, man, this is not fair. I got like 15 stops to go. Then I got to take a bus to get to my apartment. No, man, this fucking sucks. I, of all people, deserve these seats. So I point to the seats, and the girl is annoyed, and she takes her bags off the seats, and I sit down. And when I sit down, my leg kind of brushes her a little bit, and she looks at me, she goes, "Damn, can't say excuse me nothing?" And I look at her, and I just blurt out, "No, I can't." She gets so angry, and I get so scared. And immediately she takes out her phone, calls her friend, and starts talking shit about me. And she's talking about how she wants her to get her friends to meet me on my stop, to kick my ass, and how she's going to mess me up. And then she starts talking bad about me in Spanish. The funny thing is that I speak Spanish. So I know everything she's saying about me. Then she goes and says, "This white boy thinks he's better than me." And I find that kind of really hysterical because both my parents are Puerto Rican. I was born in the Bronx, but my parents moved me down when I was 3. And they made a big point of speaking English around the house because they wanted me to keep my English. They wanted me to, because they felt like it was going to be a big advantage for me when I grew up. What they didn't really understand was that it was a double-edged sword. Yeah, it did help me eventually in the future, but it also made me very isolated. Kids my own age thought I was weird. You know, they couldn't really understand why I read, you know, not for homework. I pretty much buried my face in comic books, Marvel Comics, fuck DC, and Christopher Pike books and Fear Street from R.L. Stein and, you know, it's just like a lot of like, you know, adult stuff. And I was glued to TV. Like my favorite shows growing up were Reading Rainbow and Doogie Howser. I kind of like patterned my speech about that. My vocabulary got better and better and better. And I made friends and it was fine in high school. But then after high school, I was in a really bad situation. And the reason is because in Puerto Rico's been part of the U.S. for like over 100 years. Before that, there were a colony of Spain. So when they came over, this kind of created a big identity crisis where it became a national question of what makes a Puerto Rican. Is it the color of his skin? Is it that he was born in Puerto Rico? Or is it that he speaks Spanish only? And I did not meet the criteria for any of those. So I was fucked. So I would have like these experiences. Like the one that stands out the most to me was when I was in a chat room, you know, back when the internet was new. And I'm like chatting away and I'm talking to this girl and she's really cute. And I find out she's from Guaynabo, which is like a town like 20 minutes away from me. And I go, "Hey, I see you're from Guaynabo. I'm from Bayamon." And she goes, wait, what?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm from Bayamon." And she goes, "But you said your name was Brian." And I go, "No, I said I like Brian Adams." And she goes, "Well, how long you been in Bayamon?" And I'm like, "Since I was 3. And she goes and says, "So why are we speaking English right now? Why aren't we speaking Spanish?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I like to speak English. It's my preferred language. My mind kind of works that way. Yada, yada, yada." And she goes and says, "Well, I don't want to talk to you anymore." And I go, "Why?" And she goes, "Because I only talk to real Puerto Ricans." So now I'm halfway to my stop, and this girl is saying stuff in English like, "Does Pedro still have his bat? Does Jose still have his gun? I know they have priors, but I think we can get away with this." And then in Spanish, she's saying to her, she's trying to figure out my stop because she's in Gun Hill Road. That's all the way to the end of the 5 train. She's saying stuff like, "I think he gets off on 96th Street because all white people get off on 96th Street. No white person goes past 96th Street." And I'm thinking to myself, this is ridiculous. So the thing is, like, when I moved to New York, my world was opened up. I start to meet people from different races, ethnicities, and stuff like that. And a really weird thing started to happen to me. That was when I was being confused for being of other races and ethnicities. Like, I got confused for being Jewish, Italian, one time Pakistani. But most I get confused for being white. Situations would happen what I mean with coworkers or, you know, people I just met, acquaintances, and the topic of where you're from comes up, and I'll say, well, I'm from Puerto Rico. I was raised there. And they go, wait a minute, you're Puerto Rican? And I go, yeah. And they go, but you speak English so well. Or, you don't sound like a Puerto Rican. And my reply was always, you don't sound like a racist, but hey, I guess the world is full of surprises, isn't it? But eventually, I had these conversations over and over and over again that I got fed up, and I would just avoid the question. You know, I let people believe what they want to believe. And that's when I became a undercover Puerto Rican. And I would have, like, these really weird experiences, you know? Like, I was at this story slam called The Moth, where folks, they rate your story. And so I'm sitting next to this, like, little old lady, and she has, like, the little perm and the sweater and the little purse and stuff like that. And she looks like your grandma. I'm going to call her Blanche because both Kevin and me love the Golden Girls. And she goes and says, hey, I put my name in the hat. I'm doing stand-up right now, and I can't wait to get on stage. And I go, hey, that's nice. That's great. And she gets called up, and she tells a story, and it's fucking horrible. She has no structure whatsoever. She's going all over the place. It's kind of a boring story. But, you know, whatever. She gets bad scores, and she comes down and sits next to me. And then a Colombian man gets called up, and he goes on stage, and he tells the most amazing story. It was amazing. And he got these amazing scores, and eventually later on won them off. And when he gets his scores, she leans over to me and she says, hey, I guess you gotta be a spick to get good scores around here. And I was floored. I was like, Blanche, you racist bitch. Living up to the Southern stereotype. I thought that, you know, but I still think about this to this day. I didn't say it, and I just froze. And at the end of the night, she gets up and shakes my hand and says, it was really nice talking to you. And I even smiled a little bit, you know? I hated myself for that. I could have stood up for my people. I could have stood up for where I came from. I could have said, fuck you. But I didn't. I didn't say anything. I just stood there and smiled. So now I'm coming to the end of my stop. I'm pretty much sure this girl's full of shit because the logistics just don't work. Like, how's she going to get her friends to my stop in time to kick my ass? And, well, she's going to hold me there. That's not going to work, you know? She's talking to her friend in Spanish, talking about how scared I must be and blah, blah. And I'm like, whatever. I get to my stop, and it's hour 10. I get up in hour 10, and I get up from the seat, and she starts screaming on her phone, he's getting off for hour 10! He's getting off for hour 10! And I look at her, and I think about Blanche, and I just go, yo soy boricua! Yeah. And she doesn't really know how to respond to that. And I don't really know how to follow that up. So I just, like, walk off the subway station. My stage, you know? Like, I walk off the subway station, you know? I'm waiting for the bus, and I'm thinking about what just happened. I'm going like, holy shit, I can't believe this fucking happened. And I think to myself, you know what, man? I'm like this racial nomad. Like, I wear all these faces. But, like, my true face, the face that I wear, people say, well, you shouldn't wear that face because you don't live up to the stereotype or you don't live up to our standards. I'm thinking about that, and I just go, you know what? Fuck it. Yo soy boricua. This white boy thinks he's better than me. I speak Spanish. Both my parents are Puerto Rican. I was born in the Bronx. I'm from Bayamon. I'm from Puerto Rico. I was raised there. Wait a minute, you're Puerto Rican? I got confused for being Jewish, Italian, one time Pakistani. But most I get confused for being white. You don't sound like a Puerto Rican. Fuck it. Yo soy boricua. Yo soy boricua. Yo soy boricua. Yo soy boricua. Yo soy boricua!
Okay, so when I moved to Los Angeles, I was in a huge life transition. I was changing my career. I was leaving academia to go write for entertainment. And as an academic, I was a cultural historian. And my specialization in American history was the intersection of nationalism, liberal politics, and the construction of sexual and gender identity in post-war dance theater. It's a burgeoning field. In addition to that isolating field of study, I'd also gotten out of a long-term relationship, and I was dating around, and I didn't know that many people. And finally, I met somebody. I met somebody who had that perfect combination of being intriguing and annoying. I was hooked. I loved that. So we went out a couple times, but it never really launched. But at the time, he was also the only person I knew who produced television. So we kind of kept in touch on and off. And a couple years after we met, I asked if we could get together and talk about how I might transition into TV writing. And he said, yes. So we do that. We get together and there's still a really big attraction for me. And we start talking about how I can make this career transition. And we develop a working relationship and a personal one. And he helps me out a lot. And he doesn't ask for anything in return. And he's a great resource to me. And I'm new in the city, so I don't have that many friends. And he sees a part of me, and that feels really good. He likes that I'm smart, he's impressed by me, and it's really nice to feel received in this city that can make you feel so anonymous a lot of the time. So I start sending him my writing, and we're talking about our projects, and then we always make out after the meetings. Yeah, we're like teenagers. It's all kissing and heavy petting. And one day, he says to me, I want to take you to the mall and buy you a pair of jeans. And I think, well, that's weird, but okay. So I go try on a bunch of jeans, and then we make out in the dressing room of the Bloomingdale's in the Beverly Center. And then we talk about the pilot I just wrote. This city is so romantic. So one week I get really sick, and he's very kind. He comes to my house and he brings a bag of groceries, and he brought me bread, milk, fruit, like probiotic yogurt. He makes me tea, he massages my feet, and he knows how to care for someone, and that's really attractive because I'm new here and there is no one who really takes care of me. And it feels like a relationship, but it doesn't have a name, and we're not sleeping together. But I'm thinking about him constantly. He comes back to my place a couple weeks later to congratulate me on winning this writing competition. And he brings me champagne and oil and vinegar and loose teas. And then he brings me a t-shirt to sleep in because he knows that I like to sleep in t-shirts. And these gifts are domestic and they're intimate. And we sit on the couch and he holds my hand and he kisses me. Like he really wants me. There's intent behind the kiss. And he's looking at me like I'm a decision. And I'm on the campaign trail. Okay? I am the best version of myself. I'm composed. I'm groomed. I'm polished. I'm available. Pick me. I want the job. I want to be the girlfriend. I want to be the TV executive's post-divorce girlfriend. And another week passes, and I have to sing in this choir concert, and I'm still trying to get over this cold, and so I ask him, do you have a humidifier? And he does, and he comes to my office an hour later, and he brings me his humidifier. And I think, this guy is into me. He must want me. Who showers a person with gifts and brings a humidifier to their office? This is proof. But he's not making any plans with me, and he's not asking for more of my time. So I decide that this is a slow roll, and I need to carry on with my life and whatever it is that I need to do for myself until he comes around. I'll just chip away at him until I win. So I try to go out with other people because I know that someone who is skittish is very suspect of people who are into them too much, and I know this because I am one of those people. So the following week, I try to have dinner with somebody else, some man I couldn't possibly fuck, and he's an autistic lawyer, and we go to dinner at Matzah, and he brings one of those legal pads with him. Very embarrassing. But before I go over there, I'm on the way to this other man's house. It's close enough. I think I'll put the humidifier in my trunk, and I'll just drop it off at his house because I'm done with it. and that's fine. And so I do that. I drive to this guy's house after my dinner with this other embarrassing man, and I didn't really even know if he'd be home, but I showed up, and right as I pull up to the apartment, I see him driving, and I think, oh, perfect, great, good. I didn't even know if he'd be home. I'll watch him park, and then I watch him walk into the building, and I think, well, I could intercept him and give him the humidifier, but if I do that, then he won't invite me in, and I want in there. So I wait for him to go in his apartment, and I pull the humidifier out of the trunk. I walk into the building. I start climbing the stairs, and I hear voices behind the door, and then I hear a woman's voice. And she says, I bought that milk you like from Trader Joe's. And I just freeze. The blood drains out of my body. I feel a pulse in my neck. I hear this tap, 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 tap sound, and I don't know where it's coming from, and I realize that my high heels are tapping against the marble in the apartment building, and my legs are shaking so hard, I can't even feel my body. He's with somebody. That's what all the caginess is about. He's been with someone long enough for them to know what he likes from the grocery store. And I'm frozen, and I just stand in the hallway. I stand there for 10 minutes behind the door, listening to their conversation. I can't move. And I'm still clutching this humidifier in my arms like it's some kind of stillborn baby. It's the only thing I have left. You know, this cheap plastic Rite Aid humidifier that was supposed to make it easier to breathe, and now I can't breathe at all. And I don't know who they are to each other, but I can hear time between them. They sound relaxed. They sound in good spirits. Time between people has a sound. And I can't take it anymore. So I don't know what's behind the door, but I want to know. And so I decide that I'm going to knock on the door and I'm going to confront this. And I knock really softly, but nobody comes to the door. And I'm standing there long enough, and I just think, you have to leave. You should just go. It's raining outside. I don't have an umbrella. I don't have a jacket. And I just think, well, it's time. It's done. So I put the humidifier on the welcome mat, and I turn to leave. And I get down a couple of the stairs when the door opens. And I turn up, and I look. And there's a short woman in her sweatpants, looking very nice and unsuspecting. And then I see him standing next to her, and he can see me looking down on the stairs, and he's shocked. He's caught. And I just nod to him and say, thanks, acknowledging the humidifier. And he just chirps back, oh, you're welcome, like I'm a neighbor. She picks up the humidifier, and they go inside. And so I run out of the building, and it's hurricane-like rain, rain the way it never happens in LA, and I'm raging, but I can't even scream, because if I scream, that's going to break this moment. I'm going to start to feel all the things I don't want to feel. I'm going to be in the aftermath of the thing instead of in the thing, and I want to delay that devastation. And I don't know what just happened. I don't know. But my life, as I was trying to engineer it, as I was trying to orchestrate it, is over, because he is no longer the linchpin inside of this grand plan that I was making. I don't know what to do. It's pouring outside. I get into my car. I drive up next to his car. It's a Honda Element. And I stop, and I put the hazards on, and I get out, and I bang on the car window, and I kick a tire, and I can't do anything to him. He's in his apartment. He's safe and warm with the milk he likes from Trader Joe's. And I'm searching for something that I could hit or break, and I have nothing. And then I see the back windshield wiper on his car, and I grab it and rip it off with my bare hands, and part of it flings into the grass, and then the other part I put in my purse and I carry it around for a couple days. I'm like a serial killer with a trophy. I've never vandalized anything in my life, but it's the only thing I can do. And I just leave the broken wiper on the passenger seat, and I just drive home crying. And you know, before I went to his apartment that night, I heard a voice in my head that said, if you go looking for something, you will find it. And I did, because the impulse to look is the knowledge in your body that already knows. The body always knows. So I cried that night so much my eyes are swollen And then I send him an email the next morning and I say, please tell me that wasn't what it looked like, because you looked at me like you didn't even know me. And I hear nothing back to this day. And it's the week before Christmas, and I know he's going out of town for the holiday, and so I drive by his house a couple of times while he's gone. I can't help it. It's like that car is like a magnet pulling me toward it. It's a trauma site. It's a crime scene. And I go back to see, and the windshield wiper is left broken, and I wonder if he knows it was me. Nobody in this city sees what's happening to me. I feel totally invisible. And I leave something nasty on his car. I find this coffee cup lid on the street. And I write on top of it, prick plus sinner equals you. What does that mean? I don't know. And there's a rational voice inside of my head that's like, what are you doing? Don't come here anymore. Move on. Have a better life. Be grateful this happened now and not later, but everything hurts. I'm disintegrating. And I feel so, so alone. So I call a friend of mine. I'm crying so hard I can barely speak. And he tells me that there is a Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting that night and we should go. And he comes to my apartment and he brings me a pamphlet about Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And I read the pamphlet and I'm like, well, this doesn't really sound like me. But I may not have their problem, but I have a problem, so let's just go to the meeting. So we go to Atwater Village, and we sit in this brown room that smells like stale cigarettes, and we read through the protocol for a 12-step meeting, which is full of shared agreements, and I've never been to one before, so this is new to me. After we've identified the kind of meeting we're in, and its purpose, and our commitment, and that we are powerless, somebody stands up and says, I'm an alcoholic, I'm in the wrong meeting. How is this possible? We've identified that we are in a Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting for the past 15 minutes by repeating the name over and over again. We just agreed to so many things together. I feel like we've bought a plot of land. But I share at the meeting, and I tell these people that I have to stop getting into relationships with unavailable people because it's the unavailable part in me that chooses them. And they nod because they understand. And I pull the windshield wiper out of my purse and I throw it on the table and I tell them what I did. And they laugh and I laugh and I feel ridiculous carrying this thing around, but I don't want to throw it away. You know, I feel shame because this jerk doesn't want me. I feel betrayed because he got away with something. And I feel abandoned because I needed care. And for a short time, he provided some. And I thought that that meant something, and it did, but it might not have meant to him what it meant to me. And I have no recourse. There's nothing I can do to make him share some of this pain. This pain is mine because the infatuation is mine. And I crave intensity, but it hurts so much I want to disappear. And that's not fair. Why do I want to disappear? And he gets to just keep living. And I thought that what I was experiencing was the same thing as what he was experiencing. But he was having his own experience, and I'll never know what that was. What happened was not my fault, but I participated in the conditions under which it happened. I thought I could strategize around him. I allowed his comfort level to determine what we did and didn't do, what we did and didn't say to each other. I didn't speak up. And that's the lesson. Speak up. Don't disappear yourself inside a relationship with another person. Non-relationship relationships are not good for anyone. They're secrets. And you cannot be a whole person when you are in a secret. And I did something else too, which is very embarrassing, but I'm going to tell you about it. One night around 2 a.m., I can't sleep, so I go into my kitchen and I pull out a knife. I drive across town to his house and I circle the blocks until I find the car. He strategically parked the car farther away from the apartment because of the coffee cup lid I left on the windshield. But I found that thing. And I parked my car a couple spaces up and I walked over to this stupid, ugly Honda Element. And I drive that knife into the tires until I hear the pop and seep. and I did it to both tires on the passenger side facing the curb so he wouldn't know he had flats until he tried to pull out of the spot. And then I went home in my bed, and I just stared at the ceiling until I fell asleep. You know, I was trying to be a TV executive's girlfriend, but now I can't because I am a vandal. I'm a small crimes criminal. And for the past 3 years, I have seen Honda Elements all over Los Angeles. And I look for that broken windshield wiper. I want to see it. I want to know if he kept that mark I left, because I kept all those marks he left on me. And I left my career in academia because I wanted to have greater impact with my writing. I wanted to reach more people. And I haven't sold a television show yet, but the amount of traffic in Los Angeles is as large as a television audience. So if you're ever sitting in traffic behind a blue Honda Element with a broken windshield wiper, you've seen my work. Thank you.
Sometimes trying to just get back when you get broken down again. It ain't because you didn't try. I tried to count the days that I've been disappointed so many whole times. It gets you joining, but it's hard trying to make a living when you and get down again. And you just keep giving. Every time I get up, something come and bring me down. I get so low sometimes, feel our love won't be the ground.
This is Risk. This is the Teskey Brothers behind me now, and we just heard from Diana Dinnerman. Before that, a little interstitial by Robert Fulham, and a little bit later, a similar take on that theme, an interstitial by Tim Sutton is coming up. And before that, David Arroyo. Now then, you probably do not have very much time to go to the post office, to wait in line, to deal with the traffic, to make the whole trip and everything. Stamps.com eliminates all of that. It brings the amazing services of the U.S. Post Office right to your computer. Simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send. You get 5 cents off every first class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. No wonder over 700,000 small businesses already use Stamps.com. We've used Stamps.com at Risk and the Story Studio for I don't know how many years now, maybe 8 years now. And right now, our listeners can get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Risk. That's stamps.com, enter Risk. Our final story on this week's episode was shared by Mike Cateo at a recent Risk Live show here in New York City. Here is Mike now. You can find him at MikeCateo.com, and he calls his story, What Happened on My Way to the Holocaust Museum.
Just give up. Yes, it's hard. Hey, yeah, baby, no. Every night, every day, I'm gonna just
I felt like I was playing peekaboo behind the curtain, like trying to come out. Should I? I heard him call my name, but he wasn't quite done. Ah, oh, how are you guys doing? It's awesome to be here. As you could tell, I'm disabled. I walk kind of funny, and my hand looks like I should be a waiter. But my legs don't. So I've had several operations on my arm, and this is all I could do. I was born left-handed. Seriously, people, all I want to do is jerk off with the high end that God intended me to. Thank you, ma'am. She gets it. So this is what I do normally. I get up here and I tell jokes, but I'm going to try something different. I'm going to tell you all about a little story that happened to me when I went to the Holocaust Museum. It was 1995, so there were no cell phones. People communicated by Morse code. And I was in college, and I had this professor who taught a class called Literature of the Holocaust. And I'm not Jewish. At the end of the class, I don't know why I needed to state that. It's relevant. At the end of the class, he said, I'm taking a group of people to the Holocaust Museum, and I'm opening it up to the class. I'm the only college student that went. So there we are on a bus, me and a bunch of 80-year-olds. And I was really the only Gentile bisexual on that bus, although Mildred Morgenstern did look kind of freaky. She was giving the knowing wink to Zelda, you know what I mean? So I was the reason I went on this trip is I was obsessed with the Holocaust. Like, I loved learning about it. I loved hearing about it. I wanted to, like, there were so many people who did so many terrible things to other people, and those people, whether or not they died, were survivors. And I wanted to see what that was like. So on that bus ride down, that 6-hour bus ride from Purchase, New York to Washington, D.C., I learned a lot about the Holocaust. I learned a lot about these people who had family members that were there. Some were there themselves. And I soaked it up. And then when we got to D.C., we stayed in a really swanky hotel. Oh, my God, it was amazing. I'm from a working class family and Irish Catholic, so you know there are a lot of kids. Not to say stereotypes, but come on. So we did it. When we traveled, we would stay in, like, the Motel 666. It's really evil, people. So we would stay in Malta. Like, so being in this fancy hotel was amazing. I couldn't believe how lucky I got. There was a king-size bed. I started jumping on that bed like I was a 5-year-old. And then the bed started talking to me. It was like, come on, sit on my face. You know you want it. So I did. And then after the fun of all that, I decided, you know what? It's a beautiful fall night. Let me go for a walk. So I went for a walk. And just by chance, I happened to stumble into the gay part of town. Thank you, sir. So, by chance... Oh, God. So, I stumbled into the gay part of town. And I walked into this bar that didn't card me, and I couldn't believe it, because I was 19 at the time, and I looked like I was 14. Like, I still had buck teeth, people. So I went there, and this place was popping, people, like my peas. It was amazing. They were jam-packed in there. You couldn't squeeze through. Wherever you went, it was dicks on ass on dicks. It was fun times. So I grabbed a drink, and I was just dancing around, you know, woo-woo. And and I went up to the bathroom to relieve myself. And I, as I was walking in, this guy was walking out. And he really wasn't much to look at. Like, I think he had a pot belly. He was a little balding. But he paid attention to me. And as a disabled kid who really didn't find himself that attractive and think he wasn't worth anything, that meant a lot. He said, hi. I said, hi. And he was like, you want to get out of here? And I'm like, okay. And really, that was the exact conversation. Verbatim. No, not really. So we got out of there, and we went back to his place. And when we went back to his place, we go into his bedroom, and we're doing things. And he starts to try to talk me into having anal sex. And I'm no prude, trust me. But I've never had anal sex before. And it was, I thought to myself, well, YOLO, but YOLO didn't exist back then, so I got the copyright. I was like, you know, let's try it. It's an experience. So we get naked and we get in bed, and he was like, why don't you get on top? And I thought, okay, that's safer, right? Because I'm not in a vulnerable position, blah, blah, blah. And I get on top, and he puts a condom on, and he shoves himself inside me, and I yell, stop, stop. And that just makes him go that much harder and that much faster. And he wouldn't stop until he came. And then after he came, he pushed me off him. And after he pushed me off him, he was done with me. He laid back in the bed. This was before cell phones, so I had no idea where the hell I was. And I said to him, I have no idea where I am. Can you help me get back to my hotel? Like, most of the night is a blur. Like, I don't want to remember that time, but this is what I remember. He looked at me, and he waved me off. He goes, no, I'm not helping you. Someone else can help you outside. And so I'm getting dressed awkwardly, and I'm going outside, and I find this guy who is nice enough to tell me where my hotel was. And I get back to the hotel, and I'm devastated. Like, this hotel that I loved just 3 hours ago was now like a prison cell. I had nowhere to go. I had just had one of the most traumatic experiences of my life, and I did not know what was going on. So I thought, let me take a bath, because that'll make everything feel better. So I get in the bathtub, I run it, and it's boiling hot just the way I like it. And I step in the bathtub, and I go, ooh, ooh, ah. Like, it feels really good. And it must have started to loosen me up, because all of a sudden, I lost control and out spat feces and blood, and just there I am sitting in a tub full of feces and blood and crying to myself. I don't know how I got here. So I had to, you know, run the shower now. And I get out of the tub, and it's now about 2 a.m. And I have to be up in 4 hours to get ready to go to the Holocaust Museum. I go to bed, and I'm lying in bed, and for like 10, 20, 30 minutes, I can't really think. I can't fall asleep. I'm just lying there. How did such a nice night turn into this? and I go to sleep, and I wake up the next day, and I go to the Holocaust Museum, and I put everything out of my mind. And I'm walking around the Holocaust Museum, and I'm looking at these people who have really lost their lives and died a tragic death, and they were discarded. And at that moment, I felt discarded. I really felt like I had something in common, and I could relate, and I felt like I could heal through watching those stories. And the funny thing about all this is it affected me in so many different ways you could never believe. Like, it affected the way I had sex with people. Like, I think I didn't bottom again for like 5 years. But when I would have sex with people, I was super concerned about them. Like, even if it was a stranger I just met or was standing up with, like, I was super, is this okay? Are you okay? Like, and it really made me feel like I was not going to treat anyone like I was treated. You know, there were a lot of lessons I learned back then. And the one lesson I learned was, like, I am not a victim. Like, I could not say ever that I was raped. I do what most funny people do when something tragic happens to them. I turn it into a hell of a story. I started telling people about the time I started shitting in the bathtub after a fun night out. And, like, it wasn't until I was in a relationship in my 30s where I felt safe enough that I was able to finally admit that I was raped. And that's what it was. And up until then, I could never say that out loud. Even now, I couldn't believe I submitted this story to Risk. This story of all stories. I got so many other shitty stories. But like I said, we can really heal through telling our stories. Right now, I'm a stand-up comic, and I also work as, I'm a social worker, and I also work as a psychotherapist. I have a private practice, and I work a lot with sexual abuse survivors. And do you know, there's, like, I was looking for it, there are really no statistics for men who'd been raped, because no man wants to admit that. No man wants to be the victim. Well, I told this story from a place of strength, and thank you for letting me tell it.
Run, run, don't tell me how. Keep moving, the beast won't stop till we're dead. All the scrapes on our knees will tell you where we've been, where we have bled. How we play, hide in the autumn days, hide. We won't stop running until we reach the sun.
That is all for this week's episode, folks. This is The Paper Kites behind me now, and we just heard from Mike Cuteo Don't forget that we teach storytelling at our school, thestorystudio.org. One-on-one training, in-person workshops, training that you can do by watching our video courses online. We also do corporate training. We've worked with clients like Google and Pfizer and Citibank, you know, helping businesses communicate in a more human, in a more emotional, in a more compelling way. That is all at thestorystudio.org. Also, you can always find information about where Risk is appearing live next at risk-show.com/tour. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Confrontation, sweating like crazy,
sweat in my eyes,
confrontation,
confrontation,
this white boy,
dang, can't say excuse me nothing,
so train comes in, confrontation, doors open up and like every New Yorker,
excuse me nothing,
dang,
no I can't,
and I think about Blanche,
I think about Blanche,
I think about Blanche,
and I just go,
Yo soy boricua!
Yo soy boricua!